The Athletic.
This is Talk the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. We are back together again with Andy Mitten and Carl Anker to look back on the 2-2 draw at Bournemouth, to understand exactly what it means moving forward for United and Erik ten Hag, and also to reflect on the women's side making the FA Cup final for the second consecutive season. And hopefully this time around, they might even have a chance of picking up their first piece of major silverware as well. That will come later on. We'll also have a bit of a, I was going to call it a video diary, but it's not. It's more like a voice note diary from Laurie Whitwell on his travels and wherever he managed to watch Manchester United over in Vietnam. But we're recording on Sunday evening. And actually, talking about United dropping yet more points at the Vitality Stadium is actually a way of trying to cheer up Andy Mitten. Because Andy, you've not had a great Sunday, mate, have you?
No, I've not, mate. I had to pull out of the Manchester Marathon because I ran into a traffic cone after 2 miles and went over on my ankle.
Is it too early to joke about such things, or?
No, I think, yeah.
I suppose you saw it coming, unlike the cone.
I mean, people have said to me, you know, what a bright fluorescent traffic cone, and you ran into it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. And I went over on my ankle and I tore my ankle ligament. So I'm a bit down, if I'm honest, because I've been training for this since the 20th of December. And my wife was laughing at me. She went, you did how far? 2 miles.
Is that all it was?
2 miles, mate. I was in Old Trafford when I did it. And then I carried on running and I ran another 2 miles, but I could just tell. And then I walked back to Old Trafford and I saw the medics and they took my socks off and my ankle just blown right up. She said, you might have a break here, so you need to go to hospital. So well done to everyone who did it. It was a brilliant day in Manchester. 32,000 people did it. The atmosphere in the streets, it's a really good thing for the city. And most people have the brains not to run into traffic cones that are placed in the middle of major roads to mark a demarcation point. I was just telling me, mate, right? I said, I'm feeling brilliant here. I said, my heart rate's 117 after 2 miles, which is really low. That just shows that...
You were ready.
I was about to win it, right? And as I said, it bang went over. And he went, well, I won't repeat what he said. And then because he's me mate, he's like, you'll be all right. But clearly, I wasn't, so... I don't want to dwell on it too much, but humans have bad days, and it was a bad day for me.
Yeah, well, congratulations to everyone who completed the marathon today and, of course, raised money for lots and lots of brilliant causes as well. Carl, your Sunday was slightly better. I say slightly better, a lot better. You're at the game that Andy was supposed to go to if he wasn't competing in the marathon, because you also had an issue with tendonitis, which meant you may not have seen the marathon at all. So I guess even doing 2 miles was... something. But anyway, Carl, where have you been today?
I went off to Leigh Sports Village. I had to navigate some circuitous traffic leaving Manchester because obviously all the roads got redone for the marathon. Went to Leigh Sports Village.
Ambulances for Andy.
That's a good band name, actually. went to Leigh Sports Village, was among 6,000 Manchester United fans who watched their team beat Chelsea for the very first time since the new reiteration of the women's team. And secure their second FA Cup final on May 12th. Just a great game. Completely unexpected, really.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock, wasn't it? We'll talk more about that later on, definitely. But we need to talk about Bournemouth 2, Manchester United 2, of course, which took place on Saturday evening in the sunshine on the South Coast. Felt like we'd seen that match before, Andy, didn't it, in some ways? I mean, rinse and repeat. I mean, it's just...
You're 10, 15 minutes in and you're thinking, oh, it's this version of Manchester United today.
Yeah.
This is what we're going to see. And it's absolutely awful. United were terrible in the first half. They improved in the second half. But that was a must-win game now. That was a huge game. As we discussed in the last podcast, for all the reasons that we said, the teams below catching up. I know Bournemouth had some decent form. Bournemouth played well. Bournemouth were chasing a fourth straight Premier League wins for the first time ever at home. But United were awful. Absolutely. And the goals and the number of chances, and we keep seeing this, as you say, repeat, and we keep talking about the same subjects because, yeah, the injuries continue to decimate Manchester United, so the defence really suffered, but even in front of that, the midfield really struggled to stop Bournemouth, just like they struggled to stop Brentford. I think we have to go back a few months now, 10 weeks or something for an away win.
One win in the last seven. I saw your tweet, Andy.
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's not good enough, Carl.
The last away win in the Premier League was Luton. It's 2 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. One in seven is not good enough. And it's in a bad enough mood anyway because I couldn't go to it because they shifted the kickoff time. And we should have talked on the last podcast about the Palace game being shifted because this is happening all the time as well. And United have kicked off and complained about this, but equally, United do accept the money from the TV. So it was moved, so I couldn't get back from Bournemouth in time. And 2-0, it's just another draw. This is a team that were never drawing and now drawing all the time. And the teams below, I mean, it was a weird weekend for results, wasn't it? Because if you look at the... And I just got this dread that Manchester City are just going to win everything again. I can just see it sort of creeping up. And, well, let's talk about Bournemouth.
Yeah, I think we should stick on that for the moment if we can because, yeah, I mean, I was at Anfield today. Obviously, Liverpool losing to Crystal Palace and then Arsenal losing to Aston Villa, and it does feel like that thing that you just said could happen again. But anyway, let's cheer ourselves up by talking about Bournemouth again for a moment. Shots again, Carl. I mean, 20 more shots at goal. It means that Manchester... This stat is ridiculous. It means that Manchester United have now faced 20-plus shots in their last six Premier League games. There's 157 in total across those six matches. Since Opta have started collecting data, which was back in the 03-04 season, only Blackpool have had a longer run of facing 20-plus shots in the Premier League, and that was eight games between November 2010 and January 2011. And yet... The manager still doesn't seem to think it's an issue. I don't get it.
I think the manager does know it's an issue. I don't think he wants to say it publicly because this is just what it is at this point in time.
But can't he put that right if he does think it's an issue? Because that's sort of been the mitigation for it continuing, is that the manager didn't think it was an issue. So which one is it?
I covered this game remotely. So there was a moment 5 minutes in where Sky Sports showed Ten Hag in a dugout and he flashed two fingers, then three fingers, then two. And this was off an Onana goal kick. And it really seemed like he wanted to get United's back three, back four, however you want to describe it, to really understand their shape when they're playing out from the back. First 5 minutes, it seemed like the game plan was play out from the back, lure Bournemouth onto you, hit a 1-2 with your one side, and then play into the space behind. 30 seconds later, after Ten Hag had told these boys, 2-3-2, I want the shape like this, I want Mainoo dropping deep, I want Kambuala pushing up on the right half space. They mislaid the pass and Bournemouth had a shot and Harry Maguire had to make a last ditch tackle to bail out Solanke. And I watched that and I went, there is something Ten Hag wants and there is something his players are capable of doing and there's a huge gap in the middle. And you can say this gap is because of all the injuries. You can say this gap exists because the players, even if they are fit, just don't have it to carry out what Ten Hag wants, and that it can be physical, can be technical, can be football intelligence, however you want to call it. But there are two or three times in that game against Bournemouth where I saw glimpses of what Ten Hag wanted, and I saw very, very larger flashes of United being unable to do that. And it's so difficult because I don't know which one is wrong. Wrong. What is the real problem?
Wronger.
Wronger. Got a friend who describes things as design flaws and he describes things as balance flaws. And there's always been a design flaw to this Ten Hag time at United. We even saw this last season when the team was really good, where they send so many bodies forward when they are trying to attack that if the ball is lost in key positions, other teams have great chances for counterattacks. That design flaw will always exist as long as Ten Hag is there, but it's being exacerbated by this balance flaw that is partially being powered by how many injuries there are. Playing out from the back to try and lure a Bournemouth press and then playing through them, yeah, that's a decent plan if you have a fit left back or if you have Lisandro Martinez, who's incredibly press resistant in those sorts of positions. When you don't have those individuals, it starts looking really gross. Now, I know what you're going to say, Ian. You're going, shouldn't Ten Hag change that if he's not got the players?
Yeah.
I want to say, yes, he should change that, but he hasn't, and he hasn't done it for six or seven games now. So this is it, right?
Yeah, but I do have a problem with that, but I don't have a problem with that if that's the the collective idea, and that's what everyone is working towards. And I mean, I spoke on the podcast about interviewing Bruno Fernandes a few weeks ago and asking again about the number of shots conceded, and he went on quite a long answer, but none of it really contradicted fully what the team had been doing that day. But then I looked at some quotes from Diogo Dalot, Andy, after the Bournemouth game, and he said that the team needed to be more compact, that he thought that the gap between the defence and the midfield was too big, and that's why they're conceding so many counter-attacks and so many shots at goal. And I just find that really concerning that Dalot thinks that, because that is, again, contradictory to what it looks like the team has been doing in recent weeks. That, to me, feels like quite a glaring admission, that.
But we can also see that he's correct, because we can see that experienced players like Casemiro, he's out of form. He needs to help others around him, especially the more inexperienced players. When that doesn't happen, you get players like Willy Kambwala getting targeted because they're seen as being the weak link, because it was his third Premier League game. Got a tough game anyway because he's up against Solanke, who's a very good player, who's very good at Old Trafford. And the positioning was a massive worry in the first half. So Dalot looked frustrated at the lack of cover. Onana looks frustrated at the players who were in front of him. And it is part personnel, midfielders as well. So you've got Casemiro and Maynou playing alongside each other, not really one going ahead of the other one. But even so, Manchester United should still be playing better than this.
Yeah.
Nemanja Vidic has this feeling that it's about mentality. United get the moments because they've still got top-level players. So at Bournemouth, it was Bruno Fernandes. So we got both the goals. And without Bruno Fernandes, Manchester United would have almost certainly lost at Bournemouth. And then you see some really worrying performances. So Garnacho was brought off at half-time, really slack for that first goal. And what's his mitigation? That he's been playing all the time? Yeah, fair enough, because he could be exhausted. I don't know. I don't know what his stats are. We say the same things every game. Hoyland's lack of service. Marcus in fits and starts, little moments. He was involved in the goal to keep the move going, which led to Bruno volleying the ball into the net. But there's concerns all over the pitch week after week. And that's what ends up with a team winning 1 out of 7 in the league. I thought United were fortunate to get a draw at Bournemouth.
Definitely.
And again, it's not a one-off. This is the pattern of the team, which is now running out of time. The season will be over in just over a month. If Bournemouth was where United reached the Champions League last year, we might as well say it's where they lost it this year, because even me as an optimist is thinking this is almost impossible now. Although we saw Tottenham lose. The problem is they lost to Newcastle United, who are a direct rival.
Above Manchester United now on goal difference, yeah.
Yeah, they are. Team have lost 16 games this season, Ian. 16 matches. If they would have lost at Bournemouth, you couldn't bet against it happening given the number of late goals that the team had conceded. That would have been more defeats than at any stage in 77, 78. That's how far back you got to go. So the statistics, we all know the one about Luton scoring more than Manchester United. It looks like the season might have been finished like that. Although I'd still expect United to do okay against Bournemouth and Sheffield United at Old Trafford.
Burnley. They definitely didn't do all right against Bournemouth at Old Trafford, blimey.
They definitely didn't, no.
Or at the Vitality.
But Bournemouth have obviously burrowed right into my brain now, haven't they? Yeah, and they're starting to mess with my head because I'm coming out with sentences.
You invited this on like with that. Your years of ridicule, I suppose, yeah.
But, you know, what if United finish eighth? I can't see Ten Hag surviving if the team finish eighth.
Mm.
I can see him surviving if the FA Cup is won, if there's a top six European place. But even sixth, which we're almost subconsciously settling for, that now looks at risk.
Yeah,
it's just not good enough. You're watching this team and thinking, this doesn't look like anything like a good Manchester United side.
No.
Whichever metrics you're using.
No, we'll come on to Ten Hag and his future and the stuff in the press conference and all that yesterday in a little while. But watching that first half, Carl, did you think that Alejandro Garnacho was the biggest problem?
No, I don't think any... It's hard to come down on any particular individual here, because this is... The overwhelming sight I got from that first half was Bruno Fernandes in his lime green boots just running after loose balls by himself. Bless him. he's ran so hard and given so much for this Manchester United team since he's arrived, as they've led disaster and one mini crisis to another, and he can't do it anymore. He cannot carry that Manchester United team in the same way he did in 2020. And I feel bad for Bruno, because part of the deal is you suffer and sacrifice personally, and the hope is eventually the team around you sorts their lives out. And then when you're getting a bit old and you can't run as much as you used to, the team has got other players around you who can carry the burden. And it just didn't work. The thing that stuck with me in the first half in particular was just a complete breakdown in communication between Dalot and Garnacho for Justin Kluivert's goal. You cannot leave a football player with that much space so he can cut inside and shoot for that second goal. That was bad.
Between Dalot and Garnacho, or Dalot and Kambuala?
It's a three-pronged bit of miscommunication there that, Dalot has improved this season, but he now has, because of his improvement, he's almost been catapulted into this elder statesman veteran role. And I don't think he is, not yet. I think even at his best, Dalot is still a facilitator who is improved by better players, but he is... We constantly talk to Kambuala through his third Premier League start, and he's also giving instructions to Garnacho, who wants to do certain things. When that ball is in the air, perhaps a 28-year-old or 29-year-old Dalot will recognise the fact that he's got to be more aggressive and attack that header. But also, I'm not yelling at Dalot for not recognising things that should come with veteran experience when this is his most consistent Premier League season. This is a young team, an immature team, a massively injured team, a team that looks absolutely knackered on their feet, and they look completely shot of confidence as well. 9 minutes of stoppage time at the end of the first half, and Harry Maguire got the ball out for 35 yards out, and he just had a pop. And I was like, right, okay, we're in speculative pot shots from Harry Maguire to try and get goals now.
I think he was injured as well, from what Ten Hag was saying after the game. I think he was playing through injury from the first half, but they just couldn't make a change. But even
then, Maguire's another one, right? Maguire was dealing with a hip issue all through 1920 when taking loads of painkilling injections, doing his best to try and carry United through. And at a time when you're thinking, Maguire would have hoped eventually United build other pieces around him so he's not running up and down and trying to deal with counterattacks, they haven't learnt their lesson. And Maguire's still having to deal with the same problems he had to deal with three or four or five seasons ago. I can't get too mad at any one individual, because this is just what we've become used to and adjusted to watching Manchester United this season. And it's a real shame.
Yeah, I think we all feel that. There's no question about that. Andy, just to go back to the Garnacho change for a moment, what did you make of it? There seems to be a lot of fuss about Garnacho being taken off in games and the reaction to it. It's happened a lot just lately. You can read it as the manager trying to protect a young player who's played a lot of football. He said that he'd not trained much this week as well. But, I mean, how do you read it?
Well, his weak pass in the Bournemouth build-up led to Bournemouth's opening goal. He was slow to spot the danger of that, and that was a bad mistake. But he was involved in the build-up to the awkward equaliser. But I don't think he was playing well. I think he was one of several Manchester United players who were not playing well. And
I suppose the criticism of the change was that it felt like Garnacho was being held to account for what he'd done wrong, whereas that doesn't always happen, does it?
This came up a bit. Ten Hag's post-match press conference, he did mention the imbalance on the right-hand side more so than any other part of the field in the first half, which felt different. Ten Hag doesn't normally hone in on a particular flank, left or right side. He often just talks about spaces and there being too much space and you need to compress, or you need to, be more aggressive in a certain, in like central areas. He never goes left bit was this bit or right bit was this bit. And it didn't take too much from the internet sleuths to go to, or to think Ten Hag was talking about Garnacho, which, it's difficult. But then Ten Hag has always been, and Andy, you've spoken about this a lot, Ten Hag has always been pretty harsh but fair with Garnacho. Is that fair to say?
I think if you would have said to Garnacho in August, this is how many minutes you'll get this season, he would have snapped your hand off. He'd be absolutely delighted.
Yeah, true.
If you'd said the same thing to Ahmad, who replaced Garnacho, I don't think he would have been. I think you can argue that Ahmad deserves minutes as well, and not just seven or eight or whatever. He had half, a full half in a Premier League game, a chance to bring some magic to a team which was lacking it. But then I seen the way he sliced that volley over, that ball over, after 88 minutes, and I thought, it's not happening for you today, son, either, just like the rest of them.
Hiya, lads. I'm greeting you from the island of Phucoc, which sounds like something we were all saying on Saturday quite a bit. It's a beautiful island, warm people, very welcoming of babies, which is obviously happy coincidence given we have one with us, just like Ho Chi Minh, which is where I was watching Bournemouth v United. It was 11:30 kickoff, and we went to Lou Bar, which is on a cool road. And what we were told is one of the up-and-coming districts of the city. And the cocktails, you'll be pleased to know, were excellent. Which was necessary to get me to that kickoff time. Pretty dreadful performance. I didn't think there was any sense of attacking unity. Lots of players to kind of single out, I suppose. I feel bad, but Kombouala had a torrid time, didn't he, in that first half especially. I guess that's kind of to be expected of a 19-year-old, which kind of hints at the issues that United have got. I know they've got a lot of injuries, but the fact that you've got a lad who probably wasn't expecting to be starting this kind of game at any point this season, you know, just shows the squad building that needs to take place, really. I mean, which, to be honest, I think that's what Ineos realise as well, which is why I think they've always felt that Ten Hag maybe deserves a chance with a new structure around him to see what he can do, as I've previously written, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And obviously there may come a time when that changes. You know, performances like Bournemouth really don't help the situation, and then obviously you've got the kind of issues around certain players, I think. But I think there is another factor in all this, in that, say, Ineos do make a change in the summer and they bring their own person in, there's no guarantee that he'll hit the ground running. I think they're aware of that, just given the squad dynamic at the moment and the players that perhaps aren't at top form and what could happen in the summer as well. So I think there's an idea that, you know, strategically it maybe makes most sense to let Erik ten Hag have another go next season, and then if it still doesn't go to plan, then you make the change because you've kind of given him that chance at least. And then the kind of focus, if there's any blame to be laid, it's, you know, not immediately at their door because, you know, they've appointed a new guy and changed everything. But I mean, I do think that United need to get a move on with the results. I was talking to a waiter in a restaurant the other day, immediately said United when I said we're from Manchester, and it was sweet to hear how Mane is his favourite player at the moment. But he said that City play the better football and quite a lot of his friends support them. So Andy, you need to get out here, you need to tell people about the history of United, once your ankle's healed, of course. I'm so sorry to hear how today went. I was really rooting for you, pal. But heal well, you'll be back. I'm sure you'll do it next year, and I might even do it alongside you, pal, if only to kind of point out traffic cones along the way. I hope you're all well, lads. Miss you lots. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Nice to hear from Laurie, despite that quip near the end, Andy, which we won't mention. I won't go into his tasting cocktails either, which he's been sharing on social media. The less said about that, the better, of course. But there was a couple of points in there, I think, that's worth reflecting on, Andy. I mean, Laurie wrote on The Athletic a couple of weeks ago now about Ineos looking to support Erik ten Hag. And he talked there about the reasons why. Again, you were nodding along at a couple of bits of that. What are you thinking?
I think if Erik ten Hag is to survive, then it would be working under a new structure with good management and a focus on the culture, the football culture, because that should be a game changer for any Manchester United manager. I can't believe I'm saying this, that football should come first, but it hasn't always come first at Manchester United. So I do think with a better structure around him, and I don't say this full of confidence today after what I saw at Bournemouth, but I do feel I've not given up on him as manager.
Despite what you're seeing, because there'll be a lot of fans watching Manchester United in recent weeks, and Ten Hag even referred to it after the game about whether they're losing patience or not. He said it's up to the fans to decide for themselves. There will be some who'll be watching the way that the team's playing at the moment, and he will have lost them.
I'd say it's more than some, Ian. I think it's a totally fair question. I think you're going into majority levels now. But if you listen to the fans on everything, I'm not sure you'd always make the right decision either. You know, Ferguson would have lost his job several times had the fans been listened to. I don't feel pretty cocksure saying this about Ten Hag, because it's been a really, really poor month, apart from that moments against Liverpool. But yeah, I think he's losing supporters. And as I said at the start of the question, if he's to keep his job, then it's to do better in the new structure.
This has been a bad season. There's going to be a long summer of new people coming in, people possibly coming out. And it'll be a season, next season will be, let's say Ten Hag stays, will be a season of people coalescing and getting to learn each other's patterns. If Ten Hag stays, is there a fear that it will take so long for everyone to get used to each other and coalesce that it will be another season of development rather than a season where, okay, all engines go straight back in the top four?
I don't think the patience will last another season. I think you would be getting to the end of this calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
Look when Mourinho lost his job, December. Look when Solskjaer lost his job, November. That's the time when decisions are made. Now, you can flip that back and go, well, why don't you just make the decision now and let's start again? But actually, there is a chance that Manchester United could be significantly better next season because players will move on, new players will come in. The injury list will not be as horrific. Good players will come back. That defence, you wouldn't wish those injuries on anybody. Six different players have played at left back this season. So that's me looking at it optimistically during a time when I don't feel particularly optimistic about Manchester United. But I'll try to. Coventry City next week at Wembley. United have got to be winning that one. And then those games at Old Trafford against the teams I keep getting wrong, Manchester United have got to be winning those two. So I haven't given up. The youth system, there's so many positives there as well. There are good young players coming through. I think that some of those younger players will be even better next season. Do I think United will be pushing for the title next season? Not at all. But there's got to be some sort of involvement in a title race because it's, as you said at the start, it's been a really, really poor season right from the start.
There were some suggestions yesterday that Erik ten Hag was feeling the pressure. More than one media outlet reported that he'd stormed out of his post-match press conference at Bournemouth. Our man Dan Sheldon was at the game and I asked him, did he actually storm out of the press conference? This is what he had to say.
Erik ten Hag certainly didn't storm out of his press conference. The Manchester United manager came into the press suite after full time, fielded questions for around 5 minutes, and then the club's director of media relations clearly signalled that look, no further questions. Erik went to get up from his seat. As he was doing that, another journalist started directing a question towards him, you know, referencing that if they were to finish below seventh, that would be their lowest ever finish, and is that something he's thinking about? And as Erik was getting up to walk away, he paused, listened to the question, kind of semi-sat back down, and then decided to get up and just sort of say, look, I'm not answering that question. You know, it was clear to the room that the press conference was over. It was slightly awkward. There's no denying that. From his point of view, he will probably think that was a hypothetical question in terms of, you know, how can I predict where we're going to finish and answer that question when, you know, ask me at the end of the season and I can give you a response then. So yeah, Erik ten Hag certainly didn't storm out. It was slightly an awkward exchange, but yeah, it's nothing really out of the norm.
Thank you, Dan, for clarifying that. And it's no surprise, obviously, that people want to use this situation to create headlines and whatever else. It's interesting, though, the question that he didn't answer at the end of the press conference was about the potential for United's worst ever Premier League finish. I mean, this team have 4 points fewer at this stage than David Moyes' Manchester United in 2013-14, who finished seventh, which was the club's lowest, or is the club's lowest Premier League finish ever. Is this the worst Manchester United team in Premier League history? Is that what these stats are telling us?
Felt pretty bad just before Ten Hag came in, towards the end of that 21-22 season when the team couldn't get a win. League tables are there for a reason. If after 38 games, Manchester United have had fewer points, then you can't argue with that.
I'll try.
Okay, you put the different reasons in for that. But I think you're basically saying to a manager, how much of a failure are you in that type of question? Mm. Because
it's obvious what you're asking.
Well, only a few weeks ago, I found a stat where I think he favoured really well compared to Klopp and Arteta after 100 games.
I think his win percentage was higher than Fergie even a couple of weeks ago, maybe.
Ten Hag's win percentage after 100 games as United manager is one of the best win percentages in United history. You know, you can say playing Europa League games rather than playing Champions League games and blah, 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 blah. But we're talking now, it's April 14th. A year ago, United played Sevilla, drew 2-2. Martinez and Rafael Varane got injured. And I wrote a piece about this on The Athletic, and I'd say that game started a chain reaction of events where Ten Hag lost a lot of his luster. Ten Hag's first season, or at least up until April of the first season, was tremendous. Okay, there were some blips. There was the away record against top teams, but we were all on board and all singing his praises and thinking, this is the guy. This is the guy. If we get him more of the players he wants and let him develop the style of football he wants to play, then this team can be there or thereabouts next season. And next season's happened and United are not there or thereabouts. We're all pointing fingers and saying, is it the injuries? Is it Ten Hag changing? Is it certain players not hitting the heights as they did a season ago? And you know, the answer is a combination of all of them. But I think now the most important question isn't, you know, why have we got in this state, but essentially, how do you fix it? And do the people inside the club right now, do you trust them to fix it? It's a lot easier to fix someone else's problems than it is to recognize problems you are creating and then fixing them yourself. I think this is what a lot of the frustration comes with a lot of Ten Hag press conferences, because you get people going, Eric, can you see what is wrong? And Eric is going, I'm not bothered on that. I'm actually focused on this. I think Ten Hag is genuinely concerned about the amount of shots United concede. But also, I think Ten Hag thinks this is the best way to win football games based on the players he has fit. I was managing the match chat and I saw a lot of United fans going, why is he not taking off Casemiro? Casemiro is in the team right now because Casemiro is good in the air and his long passing is superior to Mason Mount. Why is Marcus Rashford on the field when he's not a good presser? Why don't you have someone else in? If you want someone to run in behind and stretch the defence, Marcus Rashford, really good at that. And that's what Ten Hag wants to play. So in he goes. Why is Garnacho playing more minutes than someone like Ahmad? Well, Ahmad plays a slightly different style. He wants to come and attack the half spaces more. He wants to do 1-2s with your number 10 and your attacking midfielders. We're talking right now in April. Christian Eriksen has barely played any football because Ten Hag seems to really, really want to double down, not on possession football in midfield, but in really direct attacks. Now, I can't tell you if this method is the best way to win your remaining games. What matters is Ten Hag really thinks this is the best way. So we've all got to just put on our seatbelts, put on our helmets, and just try and get through this bumpy ride together, right?
I get what he's trying to do. But as I said on a previous pod, he's all about control and his team do not have control.
They're out of control.
So there's a massive contradiction there. This idea of conceding so many shots, it's completely unsustainable, as we're seeing week after week. But then the players who he looks to win matches, he wants them to play off transitions in those brilliant moments of individual skill because they are good and they can produce those moments. But there's a complete lack of control. It's pretty alarming to watch Manchester United right now. Ten Hag's future is something that United fans are talking about all the time. They're divided on it. I'm divided on it myself. I'm arguing about it in myself. I've argued several times the pros and the fours of keeping him.
Andy versus Andrew, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, 3 weeks ago, it was more Andy than Andrew, but this weekend, people are like, nah, I've had enough of this. This is just awful. I watch Manchester United to be entertained, and week after week, I feel let down. But football can turn quickly. It turned quickly when Ten Hag arrived, and it turned quickly against him when all those injuries came. The season feels like it's just running out into nothingness, and yet we're still in the FA Cup final. There's big questions to be asked over key players. Some of the biggest paid players at Manchester United have no idea whether they're going to be at the club next season. These are massive issues. And then the new people are coming in. So when we spoke last Monday, John Murt was still at the club. He left on Wednesday morning. There's major changes going on every single week. And everyone's invested in this idea of a bright new future because Ineos and there's new people there. There's no guarantees there, especially when the competition's so tough as well.
It does feel like we are in the midst of a really rubbish stag weekend.
Mm.
And we're all looking at each other. We're all knackered.
Whoa, speak for yourself. I've never stopped wanting to have a beer on a stag. Some of us can't be bothered to look at each other. That's the best opportunity to have a beer, mate. Hey, you can't be having faces like that about my person on stag dudes. Pull yourself together, lad. Come on. We're going again.
So he's the Maguire or the Bruno Fernandes, just still trying to drag us uphill.
Just one more.
So everyone's fractured, everyone's this, and everyone's like, oh, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to do this. And I just get the sense that everyone in and around this current United team will just tough it out, the season will end, and then we'll try again next season. I am going to be very confident in saying if Ten Hag does stay, he's not going to play this style of football next season, because he will have a left back. There will be a striker other than Rasmus Højlund who can play there, right?
Carl, you've just said a lot of sentences which make sense, but can you ever say that's never going to happen? Who knows? You'd have never thought the second half of this season would be anything like what it's been. At the halfway point, you'd have reckoned we'd have had a left back in the second half of the season, and look how that's worked out. Go on, Sergio. Off you go back to Spurs. You know, like, we don't need you anymore.
I think this is one of those things where you just got to pretend so many of these games this season didn't happen.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to remember this game against Bournemouth.
Yeah.
It's been a bad weekend. I'll tell you what I saw that was lovely on Saturday, though. I'll try and cheer you up a little bit. I did go to a game. I went to watch Trafford against Witton Albion, level 8, 500 people there. And I walked in and I saw 25 young Manchester United players aged 12, 13 in the tracksuits. And I thought, oh, what's going on here? And I didn't need to wait long to find out, because Tony Whelan, a wonderful man, instrumental in the development of these young players, came up. He said, we've brought the lads along. We've been at Liverpool this morning. We've played there. We've been to a Hillsborough Memorial. And I want them to see real life. I want them to see people queuing for pies. I want them to see this level of football. I want them to get wet. And I just thought, this is great. And then I later found out that he and Dave Bushell, another wonderful human, had paid out their own money to sponsor Trafford, because it's the closest club to Carrington. It's right between Manchester United, Old Trafford, and Carrington. And while I was with them, one of the coaches from Liverpool called one of the United coaches and said, that was great today. Thanks for coming. We'd love to come over. Bring our boys over next time you have a Munich memorial. And that just made me smile. And not a lot made me smile this weekend, but speaking to Tony Whelan about his hopes in the young players, not just as in terms of what they'll do as footballers, but what they'll do as people and how they can help change attitudes. That was about the highlight of my weekend.
Yeah. Really nice, but it wasn't high barometer to be the highlight of your weekend, but that sounds great. And hopefully it begins to build bridges for the future. And obviously Andy spoke fantastically well about the tragedy chanting on the recent podcast as well. You had a lot of lovely words for that, Andy, and I echo every one of those. We want to know what you guys are thinking, of course, at the moment. We've got our email address, devilspod@theathletic.com. Please get in touch. Let us know what you're thinking about Manchester United, about Erik ten Hag, about the entire situation at the club as we head towards the end of this season. If you've got any questions for the lads, please let us know and we'll work them into Thursday's podcast. Right, let's focus on a positive to end the podcast then. Manchester United's women's side are in the FA Cup final again, and they've knocked out the favourites Chelsea in the semi-final.
Look at her go, Leah Gilton, Garcia in the centre, Garcia is there! Manchester United hit the front inside the opening minute! Toon with the delivery, Williams is there! 2-0 to Manchester United! And it's the former Chelsea striker who undoes Chelsea.
If there are any questions about why Rachel Williams is in this starting lineup, there is your answer.
Perisay. Decent delivery and the header brilliantly saved by Mary Earps. Outstanding stop from Lauren James. And Earps quite rightly congratulated by her teammates. Big moment in this game.
If this isn't a reason to smile, I don't know what is, Carl, and you were there.
Oh, it's tremendous. I didn't plan to be there last month, but you know, the opportunity arose and I thought, yeah, go on. I haven't been able to get to Lee Sports Village too much this season, but yeah, it was tremendous. I was talking to fans before the game. I had two or three come up to me and ask, is Skinner actually going to get a contract extension? Which was a news story brilliantly reported by Charlotte Harper. This has been a really odd season for United's women's side in that they are still in and around the top three, but there's just a little bit of a gap because Arsenal have kicked on a bit, City have kicked on a bit, and Chelsea, okay.
Becoming more and more unlikely they're making the Champions League. It's a bit like the men's team.
So there's that. So it felt win or bust beforehand, not just for the season, but also win or bust for Skinner's contract or status among the fan base. You know, the Skinner out is now a hashtag that goes on after disappointing results. And yet, after 41 seconds, they'd gone ahead against Chelsea. You really didn't see it coming. 2-0 up after 25 minutes. Rachel Williams scoring a great header at the back post after Ella Tooney twist and turn on left flank. This game was the best I've seen Ella Tooney play in several weeks, if not months. She was really attacking the half spaces, really making things difficult for Chelsea's defence. And, yep, Lauren James got a goal to make it 2-1 for halftime, and Lauren James played the role of the pantomime villain for a lot of United fans there. But this was a really good performance, and it was a great performance because United played in a way that Skinner hasn't often played. I think throughout this season there's been criticism about how Skinner always wants to persist with the front press that hasn't been effective now Elisa Rousseau's left. He still wants to build out from the back and you know, bake teams onto him. But that's been really, really difficult for United because Honor's no longer there. And there was always this idea that Skinner couldn't change or Skinner couldn't adapt. But this was a win that was, you know, it's trademark scrappy cup final or cup semi-final win when you're up against a bigger team. You hunker down deep, you get the ball wide, you whip in some crosses, and then, you know, when you have to defend, you keep it compact, and then every now and again, you get yourself a yellow card. There was a three-minute space between minute 77 and minute 80 where three United players got a booking.
See it out.
There you go. That's proper cup.
See it out. Absolutely.
Bit of maturity. Don't get counted.
United and Tottenham will be the FA Cup final next month, so it guarantees there'll be a new name on the trophy because neither United or Tottenham have won the Women's FA Cup. It was the former Manchester United player Martha Thomas who scored the winner in stoppage time for Spurs to see off Leicester to make Wembley as well. And actually, United will head there as favourites, Andy, won't they? There's a very good chance for the team to win their first piece of major silverware since the reformation in 2018.
Absolutely favourites. If you look at the league table this season and last season, Manchester United have had a stronger team than Tottenham. Really enjoyed listening to Carl talking about the women's team in the last podcast. And now, because I didn't expect that win, Chelsea are all conquering. Chelsea are really, really strong. I think 6,000 is a decent crowd. I know people get not carried away, but get excited about the headline crowds, but I still think that's a good crowd. And fans have got a chance to go to Wembley. Tickets are available, far easier to get hold of still than if Manchester United's men's team reach the final, which they should be doing. Try to be positive about things. We've got a trip to Wembley next week ourselves as well. There was one other negative, I've got to mention it. The under-21s played at Old Trafford on Friday night. It was a really good crowd there, but Liverpool beat them 3-0. So let's just bury all of this completely bad
news. No, we're supposed to be ending the podcast on a high, Andy, yeah?
United are still winning on aggregate because they've got that huge 9-1 win at the under-18 level.
Yeah, just, I like it.
That's how I view the Liverpool games. The 9-1 aggregate helps. It, going back to the women's team, you're right. It's 6,000. It's 6,800. At Lee Sports Village on a Sunday where the roads are affected because of the marathon and there's absolutely no public transport to get to the ground as well. Huge. And there's a real vibrancy there. They are the home crowd's getting snippier than they have been in previous seasons. Partly, you know, the Skinner out stuff as well.
Do you know what though? There'll be a lot of the players who think that's progress.
So Lauren James got booed quite a bit. She got a booking after she scored when she tried to recover the ball back for Chelsea. James, you know, played for United Women when Casey Stoney was the manager. And when the game was over, and you know, I'm watching Nikita Paris celebrate with, you know, Mary Earp celebrate. Earps was fantastic on Sunday. Really big saves in the second half.
She played with the match?
I might give that one to Rachel Williams.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Earp's made it. In those big cup games when you need your goalkeeper to make a ridiculous save to keep momentum, Earp's did that. And there was a moment just before Lauren James walks down the tunnel where she's walking past, you know, everyone's stood with their signs asking for United players' shirts. And James is getting booed, severely booed. You know, high-pitched boos. And she's looking at this United crowd and she smiles. like a pantomime villain. She embraces her role and she pats the Chelsea badge saying, you know, this is it. And I went, there you go, bit of needle. This is the first time Manchester United, since this 2018 reformation, have beaten Chelsea. This is you know, the all-conquering Emma Hayes side. And they did it by scrapping with them. Really, really, instead of trying to play possession game and outmatch them, there was a lot of fighting, a lot of dark arts, just a lot of needle there. And it was just really, really good to watch. A bit nervy, but, you know, when is much in Manchester United not nervy? And I'm looking forward to May 12th. It'll be the first time the FA Cup will be won by a team that isn't Chelsea, Man City or Arsenal since 2005. Huge opportunity.
Yeah, the end of an era in some ways, isn't it? And what a marker it would be of Manchester United's progress on the women's side if they were able to get their hands on that trophy for the very first time. Full-time Europe, the Athletic's women's football podcast that covers football on this side of the Atlantic, they'll be doing a special section on United's victory over Chelsea in that semi-final if you want to know any more about that win for Mark Skinner's side. Also, remember our email address, devilspod@theathletic.com. Please get in touch with any thoughts or questions you've got for the guys, and I promise we'll work those in to Thursday's pod. But for the moment, Andy, thank you for being with us. Go and get that ankle iced up. And Carl, thanks for being here as well, and thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.